southeast England, given some decent breaks in the cloud and some sunny spells. In Northern Ireland, we start the morning on a cloudy note, but here too it should brighten up. Just a risk of a few isolated showers come the afternoon. They'll be fleeting in most areas. We'll probably avoid them and stay dry. In Scotland, eastern areas will have a murky day. Cloud, hill fog patches, outbreaks of rain gradually pushing northwards across Scotland, clearing the air somewhat, so the skies will get slightly less grey, although it will stay largely cloudy, the best of any limited brighter spells across the south of Scotland. Temperatures here probably reaching around about 12 or 13 degrees. That's the latest weather. Steve.
Chris, thanks very much. So now on Radio 4 to The Unexpected Professor by John Carey, read by Nicholas Farrell. After completing his national service in 1953, the former grammar schoolboy arrived in St John's College, Oxford, where the privilege and luxury of reading day after day awaited him.
The Oxford English syllabus in the 1950s was a scandal or a joke, depending on your sense of humour. Its cut-off point was 1832. That is, it omitted all Victorian and 20th century literature. The unspoken assumption seemed to be that any gentleman would acquaint himself with the Victorian poets and novelists without needing to study them, and modern writing was not worth serious attention anyway. Anglo-Saxon and early, that is pre-1300, Middle English, on the other hand, featured weightily in the syllabus on the grounds, I suppose, that since no one could conceivably read them for pleasure, they suited the rigorous demands of an academic discipline. Learning Anglo-Saxon is a chore, and by comparison with the literatures that learning Greek or Latin or any modern language gives you access to, Anglo-Saxon literature is almost non-existent. Apart from Beowulf, only three or four poems are worth reading, and Beowulf, for all its fame, is fragmentary and full of insoluble linguistic tangles. I could sympathise with those who found it repugnant, and they, for their part, pointed out that W.H. Auden had famously got a third-class degree because he couldn't stomach Beowulf. So disdain for it was virtually a guarantee of superior literary sensibility. We were sent out for Anglo-Saxon tuition to a don in Wadham. The fact that he was a hopeless teacher meant I had to grind away at Anglo-Saxon by myself. But then, giving you time to work by yourself was what, so far as I was concerned, university was for. It was a luxury to get up each morning and know you could spend the whole day just reading. I felt guilty about it at first. Could it be right, I wondered, to have so much spare time? What about all those people out in the real world, slogging away at their dull jobs from 9 to 5? What about Heather, now an assistant librarian in the Fulham Public Library, and studying at night for her librarianship exams? My undergraduate life seemed pretty easy compared to hers. Week after week, I felt ignorance slipping away, and writers who had just been names before became more real to me than the half-recognised faces I tried to keep up conversation with at meals. Chaucer was the first writer this happened with. His prologue to the Canterbury Tales had been a set text at school, but when I went through his complete works, the big revelation was his epic poem Troilus and Cressida, about two lovers torn apart by war. It astonished me because it already has everything that the modern novel is supposed to have introduced. Depth, psychology, a shifty, sophisticated narrator, serious, tender, graphic sex. So my previous ideas about how English literature developed, i.e. starting virtually unreadable and getting gradually more readable until it arrived at the 20th century, had to be adjusted. I knew Elizabeth's reign was supposed to be a great age for literature. It was a blow to find how dull a lot of it was. It seemed to me that if you took Shakespeare and three or four other authors out of the reckoning, Elizabethan literature would be strictly for antiquarians. The biggest disappointment was Spenser's Faerie Queen. I read it in an old edition from Blackwell's second-hand department, and a previous owner had, rather curiously, crossed out with a single bold pencil stroke all the sexy passages. I often wondered whether he was going to read it aloud in the family circle and penciled out these portions to remind him to omit them, or whether he had found them so inflaming first time around that he wished to avoid them in future for chastity's sake. At all events, he had inadvertently highlighted the best moments in the poem. The Bower of Bliss with its two naked damsels jumping around in a fountain. Jupiter, disguised as a swan, ruffing his feathers as he prepares to mount an all-too-willing Leda. Serena, naked and trembling in the glimpse of starlight as the cannibals close in with their knives. And all the other famous stripteases that spice up Spencer's moral truisms. My tutor, J.B. Leishman, was a disconcerting figure, tall and gaunt, with the profile of an angry hawk. This appearance was misleading, for he was a kind man. He kept open house on Thursday evenings, when his pupils could bring their friends for coffee and chat, and he would play choice items from his big collection of gramophone records. It was on one of these evenings that I first heard W.B. Yeats' quavering sing-song rendition of the Lake Isle of Innisfree. Leishman was a lecturer at St. John's, not a fellow, which is why he did not have a college room and had to teach round the clock to earn enough to live on. I was told he was considered too eccentric to be a fellow, but so far as I could see, he was a more distinguished scholar than many of those deemed normal enough to be fellows of St. John's. A classicist by training, he had a wide and precise knowledge of modern European literatures, especially German and Italian. His great love was the German poet Rilke, and the first of his translations of Rilke, the Sonnets to Orpheus, had been published by the Hogarth Press back in 1936, so I suppose he must have known Virginia and Leonard Woolf. Though I envied his learning and wanted to be like him, I now think he was perhaps a sad and lonely man. I envisage him giving endless tutorials to the callow bunch of idiots that we must have seemed to him, and then I think of Rilke's heart-rending poem about the panther in the Jardin des Plantes in Paris, plodding endlessly round its cage, which Leishman translates, "His gaze those bars keep passing is so misted with tiredness it can take in nothing more. He feels as though 1,000 bars existed, and no more world beyond them or before." I've wondered whether, like so many of his generation, he was one of those who yearned for male love, but was inhibited by his upbringing and convention. I hope I'm wrong about his being sad. He died in 1964, falling from a mountain path in Germany, and there was some talk of suicide. But others said he was trying to pluck a flower, an edelweiss, which he could not quite reach. Wordsworth was the last poet I studied with him. We ran out of syllabus after that. It's easy to pretend you have read Wordsworth when you haven't. You can hold forth about nature worship or his curious relations with his sister Dorothy, and I had done that, and now felt ashamed of it. So as a kind of atonement, I read him right through in the microscopically printed single-volume Oxford edition. My life had not been at all like Wordsworth, but he made me feel it had. I think that's a common experience. It's part of his greatness that he can make you recognize something in yourself that answers to his feelings. When he wrote, "The sounding cataract haunted me like a passion," I was back beside the weir at Radcliffe-on-Trent, deafened by the din. When he wrote about tree climbing as a boy, "The sky seemed not a sky of earth, and with what motion moved the clouds? I felt the trees sway under me." Those lines are very characteristic, because he doesn't tell you what the sky did seem like, or how the clouds did move. He leaves you to imagine it, and the effect is that you write the poem for yourself. Maybe it's because we are so used to finding that we can't put our deepest feelings into words, that when Wordsworth says he can't either, we are stirred to our depths. To me, the meanest flower that blows can give thoughts that do often lie too deep for tears. He is the only poet who can point so unerringly to the aching gulfs in ourselves that lie beyond poetry, beyond expression, beyond help. I spent as little time as I could in the world outside books, and for the most part, it bumped along satisfactorily without me. Though I had saved up my army pay and had a scholarship, I was short of money, so I got vacation jobs. During several vacations, I worked as a barman in Liverpool Street Station. Our boss was a thin, bespectacled man called Alf, who wore a brown packing coat and was chronically uncommunicative. The only thing he ever said was, "Want a wet?" which meant, "Did we want a drink?" We always said yes, of course, and would follow him down rickety metal stairs and along gantries into the bowels of Liverpool Street Station, where gigantic kegs of various beers lay on their sides, with thin metal pipes leading up from them to the pumps in the bars above. Alf had discovered some, I suppose, illicit way of tapping these monsters, and he silently handed round brimful pint glasses. The cellar was chill and bare, and we sat on the stone floor, leaning against the walls while we drank, so it was not what you would call festive. Still, it was free alcohol. I was working there when my 21st birthday came round, and as the Carey family did not go in for parties, Alf's bootlegged beer was as near as I got to a celebration. My parents, though, gave me a Rolex Oyster watch, which must have cost them a lot, and which I still have. Heather gave me a chess set. I still have that too, but fairly soon I no longer had Heather. She had been up to see me in Oxford several times and stayed the night. Then one day, at the start of my second year, at a lecture by Leishman in St. John's Hall on the subject of Milton's minor poems, I caught sight of a girl sitting on a bench on the far side of the hall. She had her back to me, but was turning towards the lecturer, so I saw her in profile. She was petite and demure-looking and very pretty, and after the lecture, I walked back to my room in a daze. Next week she was there again, and I followed her out of the hall and afterwards made some cringe-making attempt at a chat-up line. She seemed surprised, but not offended, and when we got to where her bike was parked, I asked her to tea. She made an excuse, as I expected she would, but I discovered she was called Jill and that she was reading English at St. Anne's. That was the start of a long campaign of attrition on my part, during which she gradually became resigned to her importunate wooer. As a second-year scholar, I had a beautiful white-panelled room overlooking the front quad, and I was proud to be able to ask her there when she did agree to come to tea. I laid out my possessions to impress her: the Bakelite radio, the coffee pot, and I'm ashamed to say, Heather's chess pieces set up as if for a game. The first time I took her out was to a performance of The Nutcracker at Oxford's New Theatre. I remember glancing sideways at her during the first act and feeling astonished that I had something so precious in my care, even for an evening. Years later, she told me she was wondering what drink she ought to ask for in the interval, supposing I offered her one. Heather had to be told what had happened, which was horrible. She didn't cry, and I was grateful for that, but I felt base and treacherous. Of course, it never occurred to me that she might not consider me such a terrible loss, and I was a bit surprised to learn, not long after, that she had married someone else and started a family and was happy. So perhaps I need not have felt such a worm.
Nicholas Farrell was reading from The Unexpected Professor by John Carey. It's abridged and produced by Jill Waters, and it's a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. In the final part tomorrow, we'll hear how the perils of being outspoken in the national press sometimes led to unhappy fractures. This is Radio 4. The shipping forecast is next. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 4th of April. The general synopsis at 1800, low, southern England 1000, moving slowly north and losing its identity. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, northeast 40s, variable 3 at first in North Utsira, otherwise southeasterly 4 or 5, increasing 6 or 7, perhaps gale 8 later, mainly fair, moderate or good. Southwest 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, southwest Dogger, easterly or southeasterly 4 or 5, occasionally 6 in southwest 40s and Cromarty, becoming variable 3 or 4. Rain or showers, fog patches, moderate, occasionally very poor. Northeast Dogger, Fisher, North German Bight. Easterly, veering southeasterly, 5 or 6, occasionally 4 at first. Fair, then occasionally.